Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. It's true that the top 1% of wealthy Americans have reaped most of the benefits of economic growth in recent years. But it's also true that a growing percentage of wealthy Americans, in the spirit of Andrew Carnegie or John D. Rockefeller, have become leading philanthropists, giving more and more of their wealth away to good causes. And one of the leading new American philanthropists is David Rubenstein, founder of the Carlyle Group, who has devoted much of his fortune to what he calls patriotic philanthropy. In Washington, among other institutions, Rubenstein's a leading benefactor of the Kennedy Center, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian Museums, the Washington Mall and Washington Monument, and the National Zoo. He also hosts his own interview show on Bloomberg Television and recently published a fascinating collection of his interviews with outstanding Americans called The American Experiment. Recently, David Rubenstein sat down for his own interview with me at Washington's Hill Center on Capitol Hill. And David, it's wonderful to see you. And I want to congratulate you on his latest three books, I believe, The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream. The book is just out, so it is, pardon the pun, hot off the press. It is a wonderful collection of interviews and conversations with some of the most interesting and important people in America, and their reflections on the American dream. Is it still alive today? What it means to be an American today? What are the challenges facing America? I've had a chance just the last few days to read many, many of the interviews and highly recommend it again. Of all the interesting people in the book, I think you're as interesting, if not more interesting, than any of these other people.
I don't think so, but thank you.
That are here. So David started with a book. I'd like to get to the book and start a little bit about talking about David Rubenstein. We have had here at the Hill, at the Talk of the Hill, bishops and nuns and senators and members of Congress and chefs. We've never had a billionaire. So the first.
A billion isn't what it used to be. But you have people worth $200 billion, so it isn't what it used to be. And it's I'm giving it all away anyway, so I'm going to be dead when I'll have no money.
You certainly didn't make that working in the Senate as a staffer for Senator Birchbeyer. You didn't make that at the White House for Jimmy Carter. Where'd you climb the ladder to that height?
Well, to be honest, as some of you may know, I came from very modest circumstances in Baltimore. My father and mother did not graduate from college or high school. My father worked in the post office. And it's actually a great way to grow up, because if you know you've got to make it on your own, you probably are more driven. So I am more driven probably than my children are driven, because they've grown up in a wealthier setting, though they are reasonably driven. I would say that I got lucky in life. I got scholarships to Duke and University of Chicago Law School. I practiced law, got a job in the White House, very lucky to get that. And then I was probably, when we lost the election to Ronald Reagan, I thought, how could we lose this election? I told President Carter, you're running against an old man. He's 69. He won't be able to get a bed in the morning. He's so old. Now I'm 72, so 69 seems like a teenager. But I didn't think we could lose. And then people used to come to me and say, David, you're a brilliant young man. If you want a job, call me up. Well, I said, I'm going to be here in the second term. I'm going to be the senior domestic advisor in the second term. So why would I want a job? Then I decided when we lost the election, I better call these people up because I needed a job. And none of them ever called me back because, who wants a person out of power? Who knows? Who cares what the Carter administration is thinking when Reagan's president? So I actually took me 6 months to find a job because nobody wanted to hire, a Carter White House aide. And I didn't want to tell my mother that her only child was unemployable. So I kept saying I had so many offers, I didn't know which one to take. And I don't know. If after about 6 months of that, she said, David, just take one of them. So I went back and I practiced law, and I was pretty clear I wasn't a good lawyer. My clients didn't think I was good. I knew I wasn't that good. So I decided to try something different. I started a private equity firm in Washington when nobody knew what private equity was, and it grew to be one of the largest in the world, and I got lucky and we made money, and I signed the giving pledge. I was an original signer of it, so I'm giving away all of my money, and I've given away lots of it already, and a lot of it in Washington, D.C. for things that you're probably familiar with.
And I want to talk about some of those things, but you obviously made a lot of smart investment decisions along the way. Did you make any bad ones?
Every day. You know, my worst one was my now son-in-law, when he was at Harvard College dating my oldest daughter, said there's his roommate from Exeter and his classmate at Harvard was going to start a company, and it was called Facebook, and would I like to invest in it? I said, that's a dating service. I don't ever get anywhere. So I turned that down. And then one time we had an opportunity to help a guy named start a company who was going to sell books over the internet. It was Jeff Bezos, and you know, we got some stock, and I didn't think it was going to be worth very much, so we sold it pretty quickly. And then another young guy showed up in our office from college, just out of college. He was starting a new company to navigate the internet. And I said, well, what's the internet, and why would I want to navigate it? And this was Mark Andreessen, and he started Netscape, which later sold to AOL. So I've turned down a lot of companies I shouldn't have, and I've made a lot of bad decisions, but you know, that's life.
Donald Graham came to you at one point and said, how would you like to buy the Washington Post?
Yeah, I knew Don reasonably well. He sat down with me for breakfast at the Four Seasons and said, David, I'd like you to buy the Washington Post. And I said, well, Don, you know, it's got some problems, not making any money. But he explained what the deal was, and that was a deal where you bought three things. You bought the newspaper, the real estate company, the real estate that the newspaper was in at that time. And then there was an online company that he said was worth about $300 million. So as I recall, he said it was a $650 million purchase price. I didn't negotiate, but that was what he asked for, $650 million. $300 million was the value of the online company, $100 million or so was the value of the real estate, and the newspaper was the rest. I said, no, I didn't want to do that. I thought the newspaper was going to go south and I would be laying people off. It turned out that they sold the online company for about $500 million. They sold the real estate for about $175 million. So I could have bought the whole thing for practically nothing, but Jeff Bezos is obviously richer, smarter, more technically savvy than me, so they're better off without me.
You mentioned giving your money away. You belong to a group called the Giving Pledge.
Right.
How many people are in it, and I'm curious, do you get together and decide how you're going to give your money away, to which causes, or?
The idea was really generated by Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and Melinda Gates. And Bill came to see me in my office in Washington and talked about it. I had lunch in my office and with Bill, and you know, he had a cheeseburger and French fries. It didn't seem like he was eating healthy food or anything. But he told me about this, and I said I was going to give away my money anyway, so I'm happy to sign this. This says essentially that if you have a net worth of $1 billion, you agree to basically give away half of your net worth upon your death or during your lifetime. Now, it's a voluntary thing, so if you never give away any money, but you say you're going to give it away upon your death, and you don't do it upon your death, there's nothing they can do. They can't disinter you. So, but it's a voluntary thing, and we had 40 initially. I was one of the 40 initial signers, and there were two others, I think, in the Washington area initially. Roger Sant and Steve Case were the others who were initial signers. And then we now have probably about 210 or so of them, mostly in the United States, because people in the United States are more committed to this. When we ask people in China or Russia whether they want to give away 50% of their net worth, they think, Nick, look like you're crazy. But we meet once a year, obviously because of COVID, we've had to meet virtually. We meet once a year, but it's not designed to say, look, here's my favorite charity or my philanthropic thing. You should give money to mine. I'll give money to yours. We don't do that. Just educate people about the challenges of money and so forth. And the biggest problem I have with the Giving Pledge is, well, I think it's good. It focuses on the need for philanthropy. There are two things I want to emphasize. Philanthropy is derived from an ancient Greek word that means loving humanity. It doesn't mean rich people writing checks. So you can be a philanthropist, in my view, by giving the most valuable thing you have, which is your time. And so more people have time than they have money. And time is something you can never get back. You can always make more money if you're in that business world. So I encourage people to give away their time. In fact, when de Tocqueville came over in the 1830s and wrote about the United States, what he observed was that people were spending all their time volunteering. He couldn't get anybody to interview because they were all volunteering for things. Because we have this tradition in the United States of volunteering and helping out. And second point is, You don't need to be worth $1 billion to be a philanthropist who gives away money. You can give away money at any level. In fact, my mother, who I would give as much money to as she would take, she didn't want money because she just didn't want to be rich. After she passed away, I found for the next couple years, I was getting letters from every organization in America that she was giving money to. She would give $5, $10, $15, $25. She never said no to any request. And she was, in my view, a philanthropist. She was giving away all of her money, but in $5 and $10 checks, basically. And I still get these letters from people that say, how come you haven't given in the last couple of years? You used to give $5 every year. Now you're not giving any money. So I do think that it's important to encourage younger people, and particularly all people, to give away something or do something as a philanthropist younger in your life. And you don't have to be a billionaire to give away money or to give away your time. Just do something to make the country better. And I think you'll feel better for doing that.
It's in your genes.
Well, I think it's part of our genes in our country, because we are a country that's the most philanthropic in the world. Roughly 2% of the GDP of this country is given away each year. No other country is even close to that. And I would say that we have a tradition of this doing this in this country. When the country was started, we didn't have wealth, and therefore people had to volunteer, people had to contribute to create a library, to create a fire department, to create a hospital. And that tradition has continued. And it's really a tradition that you don't see anywhere else in the world quite this level.
And your focus, for which we are all grateful, has been particularly on Washington, D.C., and what makes Washington great. I just want to read a quick list of and institutions which I know of that you have very generously supported. They include the Kennedy Center, you're chairman of the board there still, the Washington Monument, the Library of Congress, the National Archives, the Jefferson Memorial, Mount Vernon, Monticello, the Lincoln Memorial, the National Gallery of Art, the Smithsonian, the White House Historical Association, which I'm a member of, the National Zoo, and the Panda Program. I mean, thank you, David Rubenstein, right?
I felt sorry for the pandas because, the pandas have problems. They can't reproduce very well. We have to help them.
But this focus, what drives that focus? I heard you this morning. You referred to it as patriotic philanthropy.
Well, I called it that because what I meant by it is not to say that other philanthropy isn't patriotic, but I was trying to use that phrase to connote giving back in a way that reminds people of the history and heritage of our country, the good and the bad. So, for example, I put up the money to redo the Arlington Memorial, or Arlington House at the top of Arlington Cemetery. It's officially called the Custis Lee Mansion, the official national monument to Robert E. Lee. I tried to get them to change that, just call it Arlington House, but I wanted to have that done because I wanted people to see not how Robert E. Lee lived, but how slaves lived in those days, because we rebuilt the slave quarters there, and also to show people that despite the bad things in some of our history, we should learn it. We can't just erase our history. We should learn more about it. And the challenge is really this. Right now, we don't teach history and civics very much in our courses that much. And as a result, people don't know that much about our history and our civics. A very famous Harvard philosopher once said, those people that don't remember history are condemned to relive it. And therefore, we're going to make our mistakes over and over again. And the theory of the representative democracy is if you have an informed citizenry, you can have a good democracy. If you don't have an informed citizenry, you're not going to have a good democracy. So, for example, a naturalized American citizen has to take a citizenship test. You have to be here in this country for 5 years. It's changed over the years. Initially, when the country first started, anybody could show up. There's no passports, no visas, anybody could show up. But then when people who were not Western Europeans started showing up, Eastern Europeans, people were Jewish, Asians started showing up, you know, we put some laws in that constrain that, and it became more difficult to get into this country. Now it's a little bit easier than it was in the 1920s and 30s. But the point is that if you come in this country after 5 years as a citizen, as a resident, you take a citizenship test. There are 100 potential questions. You're asked 10 of the 100 potential, and you have to get 6 right. If you're 65 or older, they tell you exactly which 10 questions. So it's not that difficult. 91% of the people that take this test as prospective citizens pass, 91%. The same test was given by what was then called the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship Foundation to 22 million Americans. And those 22 million Americans, all were native born in all 50 states, and only one state, Vermont, could a majority of citizens pass the basic citizenship test. And the test includes things like, what are the 3 branches of our government? Who's the first president of the United States? So we don't really know that much. And my theory is by reminding people of the history and heritage, it's a good thing. Now, why, how am I doing that? Well, this is the main point I've finished with. We know what's in the Declaration of Independence. We know what's in the Magna Carta. We know who George Washington is. We know what his house looked like. Why do we have to keep these official monuments to them? Why do we have to keep restore their houses? Why do we have to preserve the documents? Because it turns out that the human brain still learns more when you see something that's official, that is authentic. So if I said, here's the words of the Declaration of Independence, you can look it up online. It's not the same experience as if you go to the archives and you see the original copy. You're more likely before you go there to study it. When you're there, you're going to learn about it, and afterwards, you're going to talk about it and learn more. So that's why we should preserve these things, so maybe it'll help us learn more about our history, and if we learn more about our history, maybe we'll have a better country.
And jumping into the book right. for a second, this is something you talked about with Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Yes.
It's a passion for her that, again, civics isn't taught in most schools, high schools.
Justice O'Connor, when she retired, to take care of her husband who had Alzheimer's, and she also spent some time, because she'd sensed this when she was a justice, that we don't teach civics very much anymore, so she joined and really kind of breathed new life into an organization called iCivics, which is designed to educate young children through the use of video games and so forth about civics. And Justice Sotomayor, when Justice O'Connor couldn't do that any longer, she has Alzheimer's now herself, Justice Sotomayor basically went on the board of iCivics, and I've supported that organization as well. And it's a very good organization, and Justice Sotomayor and I talked about the importance of civics and civic education in the book.
Right. She, as I recall from your interview, where she says that we all have a patriotic duty to learn about our government and then to participate and get involved.
Yes, I think so. I mean, look, what's the theory of our country's democracy? It's that you're going to be involved. You're going to be involved by voting or other kinds of things. And I think it's very important that we vote. Unfortunately, many people don't vote. In the last presidential election, 62% of the eligible voters voted. In most presidential elections, it's not higher than 55%. In non-presidential elections, it's way below 50%. And sometimes you get people voting less than 10% in some primaries and in local elections. So I think it's important that you vote, because if you don't vote, you have very little ability to affect the outcome. People do believe that voting makes a difference, and it does make a difference. As we've seen, a few votes here and there could make a big difference. In the last election, 55,000 votes, had they been different in four different states, Donald Trump would have been reelected.
I remember when I was covering the White House, when President Obama was in the White House, someone asked him what he thought what the most important problem facing the country was, and he said income inequality. Breaking news this week. The president of China said he was adopting a new program to create what he called common prosperity in China, to get everybody on the same level, but to reduce the gap. Do you see that as a serious problem facing the country, and what can we do about it?
I'd say it's one of the biggest problems this country has, is income inequality. But there are two things, they're twins. Income inequality means that the gap between the upper and the lower is getting bigger and bigger. That's a big problem, and it's gotten worse because of COVID. Because people that aren't educated, people that often work with their hands, they were laid off. Many of them couldn't get the kind of financial aid they needed. And the result is that many of them have fallen further and further behind, particularly young people and children who aren't in school for the last year or so. They had to deal things with remotely. In some cases, they don't have broadband. In some cases, they don't have internet access. In some cases, they don't have computers. So mm-hmm. They really fell behind. But the twin of that is social mobility. Now, I believed as a young boy growing up in a modest income family that the American dream really existed, and I could work hard and get to the top. Many people don't believe that anymore, and particularly people born in this country. The American dream, ironically, is something that people from overseas believe more, and they come here for that reason. There are 46 million people in this country who have immigrated. They didn't come here because they thought there was no American dream. They thought if they came here, they have a great chance to do better than they are in their own country. And now, many people born in this country, particularly African Americans or Latinos, do not think that they have a chance to rise to the top, because there is a lack of social mobility. There are a lot of other endemic problems. Let me just cite one of them I talked about this morning. Right now, 14% of the people in this country, adults, are functionally illiterate. They can't read past the fourth grade level. If you can't read past the fourth grade level, you have no chance of really rising up in society. 67% of the people in our juvenile delinquency system are more or less functionally illiterate, and about 80% of the people in our federal prison system are functionally illiterate. If you can't read, you have no chance of solving this problem. So we've got to do much more to get people to learn how to read.
One final question before we get into some of the interviews in the book. The United States, the Treasury Department, released a report showing that the top 1% of Americans legally evade $163 billion a year in taxes. Should wealthy Americans pay a higher rate of taxes than they're paying today?
Well, I think they probably should, and they probably will as a result of the legislation that's going to go through. And you know, I'd say, you know, I paid hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. Maybe I can pay more. It's not going to change my lifestyle. But you can take the net worth of the richest people in the country and take it all away. It's not going to solve the problem if people can't read. It's not going to solve the education problem. The problem is you've got to get people at the bottom of the social and economic strata to learn how to be good citizens, learn how to read, learn how to get educated. We still have millions of people every year dropping out of high school. You drop out of high school, what are your chances really of getting to the top? It's difficult. So, yes, the net worth of there are a couple of people in the United States are now worth $100 billion. And there are two, I think, are now worth $200 billion. But let's suppose you took that $200 billion away from Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. How is that really going to solve all of our problems? It's not, when the federal budget deficit is $3.5 trillion a year. So I'm not against taxing people more than we're currently being taxed, but we shouldn't think that's going to solve all our problems.
I'll break my own rule of asking one final question on that. When I looked at this list of all the organizations that you've sponsored, unlike Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Richard Branson, I didn't see any spaceship. I didn't see the David Rubenstein blast into space.
I didn't do that, but I was the chairman of the Smithsonian for a number of years, and I did support their redo of the Air and Space Museum. That is the most popular museum in Washington, and Jeff Bezos just gave $200 million more than I gave for the rehab. It's an interesting thing, and it shows you how Washington operates. It opened in 1976 for the 200th anniversary of their country's history. It cost $40 million to open. Michael Collins, who passed away recently, one of the people who went to the moon on the historic Apollo 11 flight, he was the first director. $40 million, built the GSA specs. Then it turns out recently the walls are crumbling down, and the walls were built to GSA specs, and they weren't very good. You know, you have to wonder, the pyramids were not built to GSA specs. They've been around for thousands of years. They're not falling apart. But this is falling apart. So it's now costing about $1 billion to fix it. We've largely raised the money, not completely. Congress has been very generous. And so Jeff did give a great deal of money to it. I don't have my own spaceship program, though.
No, okay.
Well, building his own spaceship may be the only national project David Rubenstein's not involved in, at least not yet. Again, we're talking today on the Bill Press Pod with billionaire philanthropist David Rubenstein. Let's take a quick break. Then we'll talk to David about some of the leading Americans he interviewed for his new book. Today's podcast brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers, the AFT, under President Randy Weingarten. 1.7 million teachers, men and women of America, doing God's work every day in the classroom, pre-K, K through 12, and higher education as well. They're the ones who've been meeting COVID head on, first on the online classes for over a year, and now back in the classroom, where they're keeping our kids safe and themselves safe by wearing a mask and making sure the kids do too. We salute America's teachers, members of the AFT, thank them for their great work, and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
David also hosts his own interview show on Bloomberg TV and recently gathered many interviews he's conducted with leading Americans in a new book called The American Experiment.
The book, The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream, The American Dream, of course. Overall, what did you find, that the American dream is still alive, inspiring people to they come here and better themselves here?
The phrase was invented in 1936. By somebody who was commenting on what was people believed in America. And it was really based a lot on the kind of perception of Horatio Alger stories. Horatio Alger was a writer who wrote stories about young boys and one girl who rose to the top in their adulthood. And so that's always been part of our ethos. And interestingly, you don't hear of the Greek dream, the Mongolian dream, the Bolivian dream. Because in many of these societies, you are born in a certain caste and you don't rise up and people don't expect to rise up. In this country, we have invented the idea that you can start at the bottom and you can rise to the top. Now, many people don't subscribe to that now, but the people that most subscribe to it are people that are immigrants into this country because they believe in it and actually they've turned out to be true. One third of the companies in Silicon Valley are now run by immigrants from India. Which is nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying that these immigrants have come in, they've built companies, they're running companies, and you know we have really great immigrants from all over the world. People in this country are not rushing to leave the country. There's no other country where people are saying, I really want to get in this country. People in this country are not rushing to immigrate to China or Russia. People are rushing to get into this country because it's a place where there is opportunity, though it is obviously challenging for some people that have racial and other discrimination against them. But it's clearly the American dream lives, but I think it lives more for people that are immigrating to the country than people that are born in the country.
In your introduction to the book, you cite 13 genes or values, basically, that make up the greatness of this country, including democracy, equality, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, right to vote. You find that right to vote, to what's happening today in state after state, troubling you?
It does trouble me because the right to vote is an important part of our franchise and our government. Though I have to point out, when the country was set up, the rhetoric was a lot better than the reality. So the rhetoric is all men are created equal. Well, we didn't really let everybody be equal, and also we had no women who were allowed to vote either. And I point out in the book in one of the interviews that the right to vote for women didn't occur until 1920. And many women actually opposed it, including Eleanor Roosevelt for a while. Many people thought, why should we be bothered with this tawdry thing that men deal with? We're too nice for that. But in the end, ultimately, it happened, but it wasn't easy to get it done. I do think that the right to vote is one of the sacred things of a democracy. And I don't think there's anybody that thinks that if you have one place in Harris County in Texas to drop off your ballot, that's adequate to give you the ability to have a kind of a mail-in ballot. I mean, obviously, we know what's going on. What's going on is there's some people who have the view that they are losing the effort to win minority voters and or people who are not white, older voters. And as they see those voters going away because they're dying off and they're not repopulating themselves as much rapidly as minorities are, they don't have the ability to win elections unless there's redistricting or other kinds of laws like this. So I am very upset about it. I think it's unfortunate that that's getting done, and it's a travesty in many ways.
I was struck in reading this list of 13 genes, as you call them, or qualities that bring us together. And I mentioned democracy, equality, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the right to vote. You talk about those positive attributes. No mention of systemic racism. that list?
Well, I address the issues of racism by many interviews I have in the book.
Right.
I had a great interview, I think, with Skip Gates. Talked about the Reconstruction, the challenges there.
But it is kind of a cloud that that hangs over everything else?
I think I didn't use the phrase systemic racism, but I do think that it's clear from all the interviews that I did that I recognize that we have this racial problem in our country. And look, that was the original sin of this country. When the country was set up, had we tried to eliminate slavery at the beginning, we would not have had a country. It was clear that there weren't enough votes for the Constitutional Convention, and there certainly weren't enough votes for a ratification of the Constitution if slavery was eliminated. So they basically never mentioned slavery in the Constitution, but they did say that after a certain date, immigrants, or really slaves, wouldn't be able to be coming to this country. I think it was 1808. And so after that date, they weren't going to be able to come in, but they didn't use the word slavery. Many of the founding fathers were slave owners, and I think 6 of the first 8 presidents were slave owners. That was the original sin, and we've been living with this ever since. We had the Civil War, which is what I call a stress test. We have many stress tests in our democracy. The ultimate stress test was the Civil War, where 3% of the population was basically killed or lost their lives in one form or another. And I don't think we ever have gotten the ability to eliminate that racial problem. So it's throughout the book that racial tensions and racial problems and racial inequities are part of our country system. Hopefully, when my grandchildren are my age, we will have basically eliminated that problem, hopefully sooner, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
I mentioned some of the great Americans included here, Madeleine Albright, who has been a guest here at the Talk of the Hill, David McCullough, Ken Burns, people from all walks of life. 3 that I found particularly interesting. Let's start with Cal Ripken, a sports figure himself. So here's Baltimore's own Cal Ripken, who broke Lou Gehrig's record for a consecutive number of games, and this streak of his. But I find it interesting when he talked to you that he basically said everybody's got a streak in their own life, right, that they can, and a record that they can.
Yeah, he's actually a role model in many ways. He's humble. No scandals associated with him. There's no drug scandals or anything like that. No any scandals. He was a very modest person who basically played every inning for more or less 17 years in every game. And he broke the record, and then he continued to break the record. And in the interview, he talks about, of course, when he broke the record, it was, I think the President of the United States was there, and it was a historic kind of event. But when he played another, he played another 500 games before he decided to retire. And one day, they're playing the Yankees, and they announced the starting lineup, and he's not in it. For the first time in 17 years, he's not in the starting lineup. So the Yankees finally figured out what was going on, and everybody gave a standing applause to him because he had decided voluntarily to step down. Lou Gehrig had some illnesses that really required him to step down. But Cal Ripken is a role model, and we need more and more role models. There aren't that many role models anymore for young children. He's certainly a good role model in my view.
I love what he said, that the secret was you just continue to push yourself through.
Right? Well, that's true of all life. But he was a modest, unassuming person, and I didn't really know him, although I'm from Baltimore. I really didn't know him. I did this interview of him at the Smithsonian, and pretty much what you see is what you get. He's now dedicated the rest of his life to baseball and teaching youth how to play baseball and so forth.
You interviewed David Blight, who wrote this incredible biography of Frederick Douglass. Again, local boy, right? Eastern Shore and Baltimore and then Washington, D.C. Lived on the Hill, lived in Anacostia. Probably next to Martin Luther King Jr. had the greatest impact on civil rights in this country, you believe?
Yeah, he was the greatest civil rights leader until Martin Luther King came along. And he was a man who, amazingly, didn't get assassinated because in those days, people who were fighting against slavery, who were ex-slaves, they were, in many cases, they were lynched and had other kinds of bodily harm done to them. And he married a white woman for his second wife, and that was fairly scandalous at the time. And I would have thought, and he might have thought, that he was going to be killed for that. But he basically lived his life the way he wanted to do it. Incredible person. David Blight, who's a professor at Yale, did an incredible job of going through documents that nobody had ever seen before to talk about Frederick Douglass's life. And he did spend the remainder of his life in the last number of years here.
We mentioned Sonia Sotomayor in the context of your conversation about civics and civic education. You also talk with her about the importance of immigration to this country and immigration policy.
Yes. Well, immigration is really what fuels this country, and it keeps our country vibrant. For a country's population to stay the same, a woman of childbearing age on average has to have 2.1 children. So in the United States right now, we're averaging 2.1 children for women of childbearing age. So our population would be stable and flat, but for the fact that we have immigration coming in, and that's growing the population. And I think that we often get some talented people coming into this country who do great things for the country. So immigration is important, but from 1925 until about 1965, or 40 years or so, we had a very discriminatory policy that basically didn't let people come in. For example, Jews were discriminated against, and some of you may remember that when the SS St. Louis was trying to come into the United States, or had Jews during World War II, we turned them away. We turned that ship away, and about a third of those people wound up in concentration camps and were killed. So we just didn't, at the time, the State Department didn't really think that Jews were appropriate people to come into the country, and they had quotas and so forth. So it's a sad situation. We are a melting pot, but sometimes we haven't been as open about letting people in as we should have been.
Michael Beschloss is one of my favorite historians, one of our best historians. And you talked with him about January 6th and the insurrection and what you called, I believe, a stress test on our democracy. Did we survive it, and will we survive it?
In the last couple of years, we've had two gigantic stress tests. The biggest stress test in this country's history was the Civil War. But in our lifetime, we've had other stress tests. The Vietnam War was a gigantic stress test. I think Watergate was a stress test, for sure. George Floyd was a stress test, the murder of George Floyd. I'd say Black Lives Matter has been a stress test, and a whole variety of, and the fight for gender equality and the right for people of different sexual preferences to be able to do what they want. Those have been stress tests. But in the last 2 years or so, we've had two stress tests that were unbelievable. One was COVID, where more than 600,000 Americans died. Think about this. In World War II, we lost about 400,000 Americans. If you add up all the wars we've had together, foreign wars, not counting the Civil War, we lost more in COVID in a shorter period of time than we lost in all of these wars. And as terrible as 9/11 was, we lost about 3,000 plus Americans in that night, staggering. And everybody remembers where they were, no doubt, then. But 3,000 in one day, we've lost in about a year and a half, 600,000 people. Enormous stress test. The other stress test was the events of the election and January the 6th. And they're related. On the election, there was an effort by some to say that the election was stolen. Now, I dedicate the book to public servants who protect our democracy. And I should have just said to judges, but there weren't only judges. 65 cases were filed and 65 cases were thrown out of court. And, in another country, maybe judges would have not gone the way that these judges did. But these judges stood up and said there was no fraud. The only fraud was in the filings of the people who said there were fraud. There was no fraud. And so that was a real stress test for the country. And had the Vice President of the United States said, look, I'm not making a decision here. I'm going to kick it over to the House of Representatives. Under the way our Constitution works, each state gets one vote if it goes to the House of Representatives. A majority of states are in the House of Representatives are Republican. So the Republicans would have all voted for Donald Trump, and the Democrats would have voted for Joe Biden, and the election would have been overturned, in my view, inappropriately. So I think it was a stress test. We survived because of the judges, public servants, election officials, and it's a real strength of our system that we did so. But in any other country, I think the election could have gone a different way.
The one overriding message that I got from the interviews that I've read so far is everybody feels upbeat, these people, these Americans, upbeat about the country, upbeat about the right. future of the country. Are you as optimistic as they are?
People that have had luck in life and good fortune generally are optimistic. So, you look at my situation. I've made a fair amount of money. I got lots of things that I'm doing that I'm interested in. It's hard for somebody like that to say I'm pessimistic. People that are at the bottom of the economic and social strata, they can justifiably say they're pessimistic. No, I'm optimistic. The country survived things that are worse than what we're going through now. We survived the Civil War. But we have to pull together. And right now, our government is sclerotic. It doesn't really work very well. Money is endemic. It's too important to the system. And I hope that at some point we can get the country to work together again. When I worked on Capitol Hill, it wasn't perfect, but we had bipartisan legislation. Bipartisan legislation today is more or less a rarity. So I'm not happy with certain situations, but on the whole, I'd rather live in this country than any other country. On the whole, I'd rather live now than any other time in our country's history. And on the whole, I hope I get to live more years because I'm now 72 years old and I'm doing what I call sprinting to the finish line. I'm trying to get as many things done before the brain collapses or the body collapses. And, you know, it's all, think about it. You know, you've had this body and this brain your whole life, and you don't know when something's going to check out. And somebody's going to say, hey, I'm tired of being part of you, and I'm just going to go away. So I'm trying to make sure that these parts are well taken care of and they don't want to go away before I'm done with all my things.
And that's it for this podcast and my interview with philanthropist David Rubenstein. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for listening. And you know, if you enjoyed this interview, you'll really like David's new book, The American Experiment. A link to buy the book's included for your convenience in the episode notes to this podcast. We'll be back Friday with this week's Reporters Roundtable. Until then, take care of yourself and come back for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod. See you then.